Good morning. Hello. Welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell here. Yes, for the next hour on ABC RN. Great to have you with us. Have you had a go yet at making something using a 3D printer? This is the frontier of manufacturing. Some people have had a go. 3D printing shops are all around the place. You can just land in one with a blueprint in hand and hey presto, toys, shoes, body parts, all manner of things. What if, though, you decided to print a gun? Is anyone watching? Would it work? One of our guests did just that in Melbourne, and I'll be interested to hear what happened and what should happen. Also on the show, guns are one way of inflicting harm on others, but in households and inside relationships across Australia, anger, control, a sense of ownership over your partner, they're the other weapons being used. And a powerful new documentary follows a group of men as they confront that tendency in themselves. Call Me Dad will air on the ABC this week, and we're going to meet this incredible man who's a counsellor in that documentary. He is really something else and has his own story too. Also, your My Favourite Teacher nominations continue to come in. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Do keep them coming via the Life Matters homepage, abc.net.au/rn/Life Matters. Head there right now if you've got a moment and nominate a favourite teacher, a teacher who made a difference in your life. And we've asked RN presenters to do the very same, and here is Geraldine Doogue.
Hello, it's Geraldine Doogue here from Saturday Extra, and my favourite teacher was Sister Mary Unan, my music teacher for many years. Throughout my school years and even beyond, I went back to her when I was at university to complete my piano training. She was a big, passionate woman. She was very demanding, as were all the nuns, about music, and I discovered she was very forbidding to a lot of the other students, but to me, she was compassion itself. She would listen to you. She would encourage you. I remember one point going along to her. This is when I was older, and I had had some breakup with some boyfriend, and she'd put the piano top down and said, "Dear, we'll forget about music altogether and we'll just talk." She was extremely skillful and sophisticated around music, and had taught some very good contributors to the West Australian music scene. And she was like a lot of the nuns, in my opinion. Some people couldn't stand them as teachers. They were very committed. They were very demanding. But I felt they had a caring that you didn't necessarily find in a lot of other parts of life. So I believe that I owe her a great deal. And I thought she had the perfect combination of caring and skills to make a great teacher.
Thank you, Geraldine. I think the nation owes that teacher too for bringing you to all of us. So, yes, get your nominations in via the Life Matters homepage. Who is your favourite teacher and why? You'll see the link there. And we're actually going to follow up with some of those teachers in coming weeks as we round off the Life Matters year. And you can tweet us today at RN Life Matters on anything that you're hearing, or our listener feedback line, a great place to leave a rant or a message or a story or a response. And that's 02 833 1430. And you might have a response to this first conversation today. Australia's first ever Rental Affordability Index launches this morning, as you've heard right across the news. It's been developed by a partnership involving peak housing body National Shelter, and the index tracks rents nationally in every market across all demographics, and they plan to report each quarter, so the pressure is on. And so it should be, because it looks like it's really crunch time for renters in nearly every market across Australia. And even if you have two of you working in a household, and especially if you are a single-person household, which let's remember is the fastest growing household demographic in this country, what's going to give on this issue? I'm joined this morning by Mary Perkins, the chair of National Shelter, and Lewis Price, who is the president of the Student Guild at Edith Cowan University in Perth. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello, how are you going?
It's kind of a good morning, Mary. This report makes me feel quite nauseous. What does it tell you about the demographics of those households experiencing rental stress. Reminding people that rental stress is if 30% of your income goes on rent, and I know a lot of people in that situation.
Yep. It's the rental stress figure is 30% of your income for those households in the bottom two quintiles, in other words, the bottom two-fifths of incomes. The ABS divides our families into, or our households into, five groupings in terms of household income, and we're talking about the bottom two quintiles. So it's two-fifths of the population, if you like. This piece of research was put together by National Shelter in conjunction with Community Sector Banking and SGS Economics and Planning. We needed those partners because the Commonwealth Government had defunded us, so we had to actually get other partners to come and help us do the work that needed to do that. But what it does is tell the story that we knew from what was being said on the ground was there. And there's a lot of public attention and government attention on home ownership and home ownership figures, and the Commonwealth Bank comes out quarterly with figures. And we thought that there was a need to pay some attention to the renters and what house price inflation meant for renters. And what it shows is pretty scary, really. It shows that across the country, there's variations in a theme, some states worse than others, some cities worse than others. But the variation on a theme goes like this, that if you're a household with an income falling in those bottom two quintiles, you will be doing it extremely tough. You will be in what they call housing unaffordability.
Yes, but it's the demographics of those groups that I'm interested in. So the bottom quintile, you might be living on
the
a welfare payment
the
or
bottom
a single
quintile
income,
would
no
be,
income?
The bottom quintile is roughly household incomes, $500 a week and below. So they will generally be people on social security of different sorts, and you expect those people to be doing it tough just because of the income. But the second quintile comes up to around $1,500 a week. We're now talking right into middle Australia. And the stats show, like, we're talking working people, we're talking teachers, we're talking nurses, we're talking, you know, people who once upon a time would have had quite a reasonable income to put it together. And it's very clear that you now need double income households to pay rent in the private rental market, as well as, you know, in the home ownership market to pay mortgages. Now, but those households in the private rental market will be doing it so tough that they can't actually save for the house deposit or do any of those things. And in fact, the tougher they're doing it, the more most people who are a bit strapped pay their rent first and then deal with other expenses later. And it's very clear that people are missing out on and not paying attention to, say, dentist visits because they can't afford it, children's school expenses, that stuff. But worse than that, the charities are now reporting very clearly that people are paying their rent first and doing without food.
And so the demographics of who might be homeless in Australia is going to be shifting fundamentally because of this stress. Single households, the fastest growing demographic in this country, they are doing it very tough. These are working singles who live alone, and this is not a minority anymore.
No, working singles, single parents. And I can give you a case study of a woman who was a teacher, and she had a son. She was a single parent paying rent in the private rental market. It was, you know, life was stacking up reasonably okay, but she got really sick and could no longer pay the rent. And it was only a couple of months between being housed and coping and being street homeless.
Is this the case in every market? This is truly a national affordability index. Regional, rural, cities, you're trying to get a really comprehensive snapshot.
Yes.
So we know about Sydney, we know about Melbourne. Yeah. They're loopy. Those markets are loopy and tough. What about all the other capital cities?
Well, strangely, the capital city that comes out, Sydney is the worst. And yes, you're right, no surprises there. But the second is Hobart. And that is a surprise. But the reason Hobart is the second worst is because the incomes in Tassie are so much less. So in some parts of the country, the housing unaffordability is arising because of lack of access to work and good incomes. And in some parts of the country, it's arising because of rampant house price inflation.
So Lewis Price, president of the Student Guild at Edith Cowan University, you are living this reality, as are so many students. I did notice there was a slight improvement in rental affordability in Perth, but it was such a marginal improvement. What sorts of pressures are people, students, other low-income earners, feeling in your market? What are you feeling?
Well, firstly, I think the marginal increase isn't really being seen by the people in the bottom end of, you know, the income index that was referred to. Students aren't seeing any kind of improvement. I recently just went into the private housing market myself, and I'm a single income earner. And yeah, it was just drastic. Over 35% of my income goes on rent. And then when I was a student on Social Security, and I know this is a reality for many other students as well, it very much was the case of doing without food sometimes. I've heard instances of students actually getting scurvy because they can't afford fruit. So we've actually been providing free fruit to students. So I think that in itself is symptomatic of a much larger issue.
So last year you were living in student accommodation, trying to study full time, living on youth allowance. Well, living is one way of putting it. How much of your income was committed to rent?
Most of it, because I was also living in student accommodation because I thought that would be helpful in terms of cutting down costs of transport and things like that. But yeah, most of my income went to rent, which included things like, your utilities bills. And then what was left was probably about $50 to $80 a fortnight. And that was for my phone, that was for transport if I needed to jump between campuses, which was the case for me on occasion. And also, you know, for things like food as well.
So food. And I love how you put it at the top of the list, your phone, but fundamentally food was a challenge.
Yeah, I know that was the primary issue really, because you know, being a student, we're very renowned for, you know, eating things like 2-minute noodles and things like that. But if you're studying, you need to keep your health up because you can't afford to be sick all the time, which was the case for me very much as well.
Yeah.
It really impacted my studies.
This year you moved house, you've moved into the private rental market, you're now working and studying part-time. Has that taken any pressure off you?
Yeah, it definitely has. It has taken pressure off, but the fact that for me to live somewhat comfortably that I had to move to part-time study, I think that in itself is also very problematic because it would take me much longer to get my degree. I mean, once I finish with my current position, I do plan to go back to full-time study, but I'm incredibly anxious about that because I really don't want to go back to, you know, being reliant on the charity of not-for-profit organisations to help make ends meet and to, you know, not get sick. I mean, casual work, I'll take it where I can get it, but also employment is an issue, as you know, as well. So,
and you've had to move further away. You've had to move further away from campus as well to afford
that
rent.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, and the assumption is that many students will stay in their family home. That's simply not possible for many people.
No, absolutely. There's many, many students that are reliant on that social security, but for them to get that, they have to prove that it is unreasonable for them to live at home, which in itself can also be very difficult as well. So you have a lot of people that are very much trapped between a rock and a hard place, and then it just makes things like study seem, not reachable.
Mm. Lewis Price is with us. He's president of the Student Guild at Edith Cowan University. He himself, living the picture that is being painted by a new first ever rental affordability index launched this morning through National Shelter in partnership with others. They lost their funding to do this sort of work. Now they've partnered with others to fund that process. So housing advocates like National Shelter, Mary Perkins, chair of National Shelter, I should say, have long campaigned for governments to increase the supply of social housing. The thing is, this index is painting a picture of a whole range of people feeling rental stress that might not be eligible for social housing, it would seem to me.
That's absolutely the problem, but a generation ago they would have been. We once had a social housing system that picked up the low-income workers. We no longer have that because, you know, basically there's been cutback after cutback after cutback, and our social housing system across the country, they're all administered by the states, but the story's the same, is now targeted to the needy of the most needy with special needs. It's incredibly tight. You can have a social security income and you may not get in. And there's an increasing focus by our governments on our social housing system basically being an incredibly highly targeted place where people only stay for the duration of their need. There's an assumption underpinning that they will be able to move from there into the private rental market. This research shows very clearly that is an illusionary dream. There isn't a place for low-income households in the private rental market, and those policies by government are probably a big mistake.
So an additional policy is of subsidising rents within the private market Does that work? Is it working in Australia? Is it an option?
That gets very problematic because of the potential impact on rent inflation. But what needs to happen, and we have argued long and hard, is instead of our housing policies at both all levels of government being treated in little silos, so social housing is over here and home ownership is over here and private rental is barely thought about, but it's something in the middle, there needs to be a very comprehensive and coherent development of policy and actions around our whole housing system so it works for everyone, so that what happens in one part of the housing market doesn't undo what's needed in another part of the housing market.
And what do you think is key for driving rental affordability? This is going to have to give at some point, this issue in Australia.
There has to be. There's enough money in our housing system, but it's in our tax expenditures. People who are already doing okay, who are investing in housing or who are homeowners, are doing very well by a string of what we call tax expenditures, where government doesn't tax your wealth associated with housing and gives it to you for nicks, basically. And if you're at the poor end of the scale, then the assistance you get is by grants as against tax expenditures. But if you were to look at the whole packet of what government effectively spends on housing, there probably is enough money to make a much fairer deal and look at what happens. So at the core of it, there has to be something around tax reform. But there's no point doing any of it without dealing with our housing system across all its tenure forms in a very comprehensive way, and the objective being to make it fair and more equitable.
Just briefly and finally, the way this is often couched, though, is in order to make houses more affordable in the rental market, you have to take away from those who are part of the property boom, you know, who are benefiting from negative gearing and multiple properties and the like.
Well, no, you don't. You might just target it and you say, yes, the government will give you the benefit of this tax expenditure. The taxpayer will let you have that, in effect, but in return, that property, you have to invest in property that will be rented at an affordable level. We have now have evidence of people purchasing property for investment and not renting it because it's a trophy. All they want is the capital gain. We need investors investing for the long term in residential property that will be affordable for lower and middle income households.
To increase housing supply. Mary Perkins, thank you for joining us, Chair of National Shelter.
Thank you.
And Lewis Price, thank you for joining us there in Perth, Edith Cowan University, Guild President, and all the best with getting that degree finished.
Thanks very much.
And Lewis was joining us from Durian Bay, I think, a few hundred kilometres north of Perth, in fact, this morning. And I would really like to hear what you think needs to shift to make rent more affordable in this nation. Tell us about the rental market that you're occupying and what impact it's having on our Life Matters Facebook page, or you can tweet us at RN Life Matters, or our listener feedback line 02833 1430, or you can post on our website abc.net.au/RN and look for Life Matters. Up next, we are 3D printing a gun. Really?
I'm Sarah Ferguson. For 6 months, I've been filming on the front line of Australia's domestic violence crisis.
We're looking for a male, possibly still armed with a small kitchen knife.
I've lived with the victims of domestic violence. I've been in courts and prisons to meet the perpetrators. So why do they do it, and how does it escalate from control to violence, even to murder?
How do you do that to someone you love, man? I can't comprehend it.
ABC's powerful two-part documentary, Hitting Home, starts tonight, 8:30pm, ABC TV.
It's probably fair to say that most of us sleep a lot easier knowing that access to firearms in this country is very tightly restricted, especially when we look across to the US and what's happening there with gun ownership and the implications of that. Now, though, here there's a concern that it may become a whole lot easier to lay your hands on a gun, and here's how. Simply by heading to one of the 3D printing shops now around the place. A blueprint from the internet in hand, and you just simply get a gun printed using a 3D printer. That's exactly what Alex Dick did recently in Melbourne as something of an experiment for a piece he was writing for online magazine Junkie. Alex joins us this morning from Melbourne. Good morning, Alex.
Morning, how are you?
Yeah, good to have you with us. And if Alex had been conducting his experiment in the state of New South Wales, he could have been breaking the law under changes recently to the state's Weapons and Firearms Act. And joining us is criminologist Professor Roderick Broadhurst. He's concerned that the laws here in Australia are not keeping pace with the technology. And also with us is Gail Greatorex. She's Director of Product Safety Solutions and formerly Director of Product Safety Compliance at the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. And Gail is concerned that people 3D printing bits and pieces of technology for use around the home, well, those products are not necessarily going to meet safety standards. Good morning, Gail.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, good to have you all with us. So, Alex, just how easy was it to walk into a 3D printing shop and pay for a gun to be printed?
Well, sort of, I guess, unfortunately, it's rather an unremarkable story of, you know, me opening up my laptop one morning, sort of going onto my, you know, my favourite torrent downloading site and typing in a few words and... 18 seconds later, I think the download took, I had all the files on my computer, stuck them on a USB stick, and, yeah, headed into the city, into a 3D printing store. Probably the most difficult part about it was the queue. I think I was waiting
in line. Such
is
the demand.
I know, yeah, that's the trouble, you know, city life and all that. But, I was in line for about 20 minutes, and I guess because there were so many people in the store, you know, waiting to use the printing facilities, the staff just wanted to sort of push me through quickly and, you know, it's just one more customer. And I think they didn't really take notice of the fact that I was printing out files that were sort of like trigger and barrel and grip and
so they
things
asked
like that.
Simply no questions about what you were printing.
They said, oh, just sort of conversationally, the girl sort of said, oh, what is it you're printing? And I'd sort of said to them, oh, it's for a photography project for my uni degree, which, you know, wasn't an entire lie. But that was it. That was just sort of like a conversational thing before she stuck the USB stick in. And, yeah, we had the files up on the screen and we were, you know, you have to adjust the scale of this particular file I'd downloaded. So together we were sort of there, you know, making sure it was all the right size and, you know, it clearly looked like a firearm on the screen and, you know, no questions asked. She clicked the print button and there was a 7 to 10 day waiting.
Yeah.
Because it was sort of near the end of uni semester, so there was a bit of a backlog. So I just had to sort of wait then for an email confirming that my print job had arrived.
So you rock up. 7 to 10 days later.
Yeah, exactly. And they hand it to me in a little box.
All right, they hand what to you exactly in a little box? Describe the final product. Is this capable of shooting anything?
Well, I guess there are a few caveats. So the one I printed, the file, the actual piece comes in, you know, a certain amount of files, and then you have to assemble it at home later. It would be quite costly if I'd printed the whole thing, and truth be told, the budget for the article was a bit prohibitive, so I couldn't afford to print out the whole thing. I also didn't want to break the law, so I just sort of needed enough to make it look scary in a photo, really. For
the purposes of an online journalism
exactly.
piece.
Yeah.
Still, the whole exercise is quite confronting.
Actually, going and doing it wasn't too scary. I was more worried about the printing shop sort of coming back at me afterwards and sort of, a defamation case or something coming up. But actually just, going into the shop and having it printed wasn't that daunting at all. I think, it was a little bit too easy.
Well, I'll come back to you on what you think about the whole experience, what you think should happen. Roderick Broadhurst, a criminologist at the ANU, what are your thoughts? I mean, clearly Alex didn't print out a workable gun in this case, but what are your thoughts about how easy it was for him to walk into a 3D printing shop and request a gun be printed out?
Good morning, Natasha. Look, this is one of the challenges. I mean, illicit guns generally are a pretty formidable challenge for law enforcement. And a couple of things that I quickly want to mention. Of course, you can produce these rather kind of basic plastic mold single shot pistols. You're still going to have to get ammunition. A lot of the files, the source codes, which have you pointed out earlier, have been now, possession of which are now in New South Wales at least banned. Look, it's a bit more tricky than Stephen's outlined, but it is a bit, I guess, unnerving to realise that it could be that simple.
So are guns being printed out anywhere in the world using 3D printing that work? I saw a video from, I think it was the New South Wales Police Force, yep, where they were demonstrating a workable 3D printed gun.
Yeah, correct. Look, yes, I mean, you can print out a workable single shot plastic mould weapon. It does need a metal spring, and you need ammunition. But that's based on a 2013 model that someone called Cody Wilson demonstrated in a sort of bright blue plastic. What's happened since then, there's been a very, very rapid development, constant tinkering, if you like, with the code. And what we're seeing really is some pretty impressive weapons being moulded, extended and so on 3D printers, capable of actually rapid fire. And there are some of these products are turning up even in Australia. And they're certainly turning up in the deep web, or in the, if you like, the dark, sometimes we call it the dark net, in the sort of sites, yeah, not like Silk Road and so on. So yeah, look, they're a very unwelcome addition to the illicit gun market.
So the last week, the New South Wales government has taken action and taken this issue very seriously, even if most people couldn't get their hands on suitable blueprints that make guns that work. But what did they do to the firearms legislation?
Well, look, I think at first I need to say, look, the rapid response of the New South Wales police, the fact that they've taken this up pretty seriously is, I think, very, very commendable. It may be a small step, but it's an important step by banning the possession of digital blueprints. I have to.
So it's actually illegal, just to clarify, now it is illegal, yes, to even, yes, download the blueprints in order to print out a gun using a 3D printer.
Or an electronic milling machine of some kind. Yes, look, it's now currently outlawed to possess that kind of digital, what we would call source code. And actually, there's quite a lot of source code for printing guns on 3D type machines, whether plastic or metal. I mean, there's all kinds of alloys now available. They're more expensive. And they are showing up in many jurisdictions, and I believe a few of them actually have turned up in Australia as well. And this just simply reflects, you know, for want of a better word, crime follows opportunity. Criminals are generally very early adopters of technology. And so as a consequence, at least I think the response of the New South Wales police have been to take it seriously, and I think that's the right thing to do. And, you know, there's an attempt to apply the notion of deterrence, that somehow we can deter, or at least chill the use of this kind of material, especially around attempts or preparation. So, look, I think it's a small but very important step.
You just wonder how they'll police it, though, in New South Wales. Will they be keeping an eye on what people are downloading through, you know, BitTorrent streams?
Look, I think there's all sorts of ways that they might be able to add this sort of information to intelligence data streams. But essentially what it does, it gives them the power to, I guess, interfere or disrupt a process where somebody might be attempting to mill a 3D gun from a 3D printer from a source code. I mean, look, there are lots of other sort of sources for illicit guns. Restricting ammunition is part of that game. But I sort of see it as an attempt to, if you like, disrupt preparations and attempted to produce guns. Of course, it's unlawful to manufacture guns without a license in Australia. So it's just extending that in the same way as this amendment also extended some of the penalties for, you know, altering or defacing a weapon or acquiring a weapon that's defaced. So, look, it's just a general effort on part of New South Wales police and the government to try and sort of stem the flow of illicit guns. I mean, they're under a lot of pressure. So, look, I think it's a good step. It may be the beginning of something important.
So that's New South Wales, but not to put Alex in the drink, but what about in Victoria? Was he committing an illegal act by downloading a blueprint in order to write this article about the 3D printing of guns and whether or not it's more easy to do?
No, he wasn't committing an offence, and no more than if he had downloaded something like, I don't know, Zeus, one of the very sophisticated crimeware toolkits you can get from the internet, right? That it's not an offence to possess those things. It's certainly an offence if you use them to break into somebody's computer. And likewise, I mean, in the case of Victoria, I would imagine, particularly one would hope that the other states and the Commonwealth will take some kind of lead from the New South Wales example, because it does beg that question: how much further do we need to push out? Even though it may not appear to be particularly effective, it's certainly a necessary step.
So do you feel some relief there, Alex? I'm just interested in what you were trying to demonstrate by writing this article for junkie.com about how easy it is, at least, to request to have a prototype of a 3D printed gun made.
I mean, I guess in a way, I sort of feel like I'm sort of sound of mind, so I sort of wanted to be the first one to do it, because I know I'm not going to go out and go on a rampage or anything like that. So it was kind of a way to at least get the conversation started, and it was actually an idea I'd had before the legislation had passed in New South Wales.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just sort of going to echo what's already been said, but, like, the internet's like the Wild West where it's sort of, you know, it's so hard to police. You know, every industry is struggling, and I don't think it's just the firearms industry that has problems. Like, music video piracy is always struggling. You know, Uber's now starting to take on the taxi industry. So, I think it's going to be a really hard thing to police.
It's a bigger story, and perhaps the 3D printing shops need to play a part here too and raise their eyebrows if you walk in and print out a gun.
Exactly. They had a very comprehensive pamphlet on copyright law.
Oh, right. Well, that doesn't help, though, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Let me come to Gail Graderex, Director of Product Safety Solutions, former Director of Product Safety Compliance, in fact, at the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. So, Gail, you've been thinking about 3D printing from a consumer safety perspective and actually thinking about the issue of guns. You were contemplating a case that was part of an episode of the series Good Wife, which you're a fan of. And it was, just tell us about that case and what it illustrated.
Thanks, Natasha. Yes,
So this was a hypothetical, scenario where a 3D printed gun goes off.
Yes.
And it's not clear who is to blame because no one's pulled the trigger.
No, exactly. And while it was guns, it could have been any product, really. So that they actually took the designer of the product to court, so the person who had uploaded the design onto their website. They then ended up looking at the printer manufacturer because they weren't sure if the printer had worked properly. There were then issues around whether the person who had done the printing had used the right materials, whether they had maintained their printer properly. And, of course, with 3D printing, you can, when, once you've downloaded a design, you can also then use your software to vary the design so that if, in this case, the gun handle was didn't quite fit the guy's hand, so he varied the design. And that then raised questions about where the liability lies and who's responsible.
Yes. Now, this is a sort of emblematic case of this whole sector. Has there been much thinking about consumer safety and 3D printing more broadly?
It's begun, because it's only fairly new technology from at the consumer level, there hasn't been a lot examined at this stage. So that was partly why I wrote a white paper at the start of this year to just try and explore and tease out some of the issues and see what action might need to be taken.
Okay, so what action do you think does need to be taken?
Well, it's a case with product safety. We say everybody has a role to play, the manufacturers, retailers, governments and consumers. Primary responsibility lies with the manufacturer, typically, and the people designing, because if you can design safety into a product and eliminate the hazard at the outset, then that's the best way of making a product safe. In this case, it's still a case that everybody has to have a role to play. So I think that there needs to be focus on the designers and also the people who are making the 3D printers for sale to consumers. I think they can take the lead on this primarily.
It's so distributed though, isn't it? If I want to go into a shop and get something 3D printed, I might take a blueprint off the net. There's a designer who came up with the blueprint. I might go into the shop and together we might modify that design in some way. And then you get a product. It's difficult to establish who should be accountable.
Oh, absolutely. And I know that some of the 3D print shops that have opened up in Australia have thought long and hard about what their role might be in this field, and there's some accountabilities being built in. But of course, people can own a 3D printer at home as well, so there's nothing stopping them in that context.
So the shops might be thinking about it. Is there actually an organised 3D printing industry in Australia that might play a role in advocating consumer safety?
Yes, there's certainly a number of organisations that are involved, and I'm actually involved this afternoon in Brisbane. Griffith University is running a forum, and there's a number of industry bodies, and also the universities are definitely involved.
Mm. On the other hand, could 3D printing be an absolute boon for people's households? Might improve their lives in ways rather than increase risk?
Well, there's the 3D printing offers some fantastic opportunities, and indeed you can print products with 3D printing that can't be printed any other way. So that's a real bonus. From a safety point of view, I've thought about things like trying to get people to wear protective gear, like a helmet or elbow pad or goggles, say, if you're doing some welding. Some people resist that because they're uncomfortable. But with 3D printing, you could customise and tailor the product so that it fitted your body effectively, and it might encourage people to wear protective gear. Mm. That's one innovation. There's also, with 3D printing, there's often fewer moving parts in a product, so sometimes that can be helpful from a design point of view.
It's such fascinating terrain to me. Rod Broadhurst, do you think that most states, when it just coming back to the 3D printing of gun issue, do you think most states will follow suit in terms of what New South Wales has done to make it illegal to download blueprints for guns?
Yes, look, I think most states will follow, and hopefully the Commonwealth law will be amended as well. I'm pretty confident that that's already a matter for consideration at the Commonwealth level, and it would be really important, I think, to try to get a national approach. Like I say, I mean, the New South Wales approach has been very rapid, and it's a small but, as I said before, an important step, and it does raise this question about what extent we need to criminalise things like crimeware. I think that 3D printers are necessarily crimeware at all. They're going to bring many benefits, as Gail's pointed out, but there's always some downside to new technology, and we're just looking at one of these unintended consequences, I think.
Yeah. Alex, now that you've got the blueprint, 3D printer thing going on, any plans for the future? What are you going to print out next? A new car? I need new car.
Oh, that'd be nice.
A new bike? I need one of those too.
Don't know if that sort of stuff fits in a 3D printer just yet, but actually I've been doing a bit of research into biomedical 3D printing, and as you were just saying, there are benefits to 3D printing technology as well. So there are people now, like there's Rice University in the US are doing a lot of open source 3D printing of human kidneys and liver tissues and stuff like that. So, maybe not just yet, but, 40 years down the line when this technology is commercially available, I might print myself some new organs if I ever need them.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think I'll be printing out any more firearms in the near
future.
Well, no,
that's right.
Though.
It was an interesting experiment. Thanks for joining us to talk about
worries.
It. I was
Thank you very
fascinated
much.
By it. Alex Dick, he's a journalist who recently wrote an article about 3D printing of a gun in a Melbourne 3D print shop for junkie.com. And Gail Greatorex, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Director of Product Safety Solutions. Good luck with that afternoon symposium on all this issue. And Professor Rod Broadhurst, Professor of Criminology at the ANU. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Natasha.
Yeah, I wonder what you've tried to 3D print. Could it be a gun? Well, New South Wales has made headroads down there, that path. Looking forward to your comments on the Facebook page about this one. I know my cousin 3D prints a few things. Up next, I've just been watching a documentary called Call Me Dad. It's airing on the ABC this week, and it is profound. David Nugent is joining us in a tick.
Hear all your favourite radio stations from right around the country on the ABC Radio app.
In a moment, you're going to be hearing from
Fran Kelly with you.
From Radio National to Triple J. Hear us now. Hear us anywhere.
Hey, Tom Tilley here.
So keep the text coming through.
And if you love a great podcast, we've got you covered with arts, ideas, stories and more.
Welcome back to Conversations.
You're with All in the Mind.
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Dan.
Download the free ABC Radio app now. Hear, hear.
Every time I've seen the television promo for Sarah Ferguson's two-part documentary Hitting Home, which screens over two evenings from tonight on ABC TV, I have felt chilled to the bone. It's a visceral and immediate reaction, and perhaps you've had the same response to those promos. I know I'm not alone, because if you've lived in a family violence situation, you will feel it too. And the tragedy of domestic violence is that it's intergenerational. So when children live with emotionally or physically violent parents, especially boys, it seems, they too risk becoming perpetrators in their own relationships as adults. It's a sad and difficult truth. During White Ribbon Week on Thursday, you will have the chance to see a very important new documentary on ABC TV called Call Me Dad, which aims to break that cycle of violence for three men for whom anger lives large. Let's just hear a little bit of it.
Some men terrorise the ones they love.
Didn't take no shit from anybody.
He was like a bomb waiting to go off.
His strength becomes tenfold.
I don't hit her with a fist like I'd hit a man.
It can be quite serious. It can be life-threatening.
I was woken by him dragging me off the couch by my throat.
Happy family, real happy family, doesn't exist.
But can an abusive man really change?
Don't think I'll ever be respectful to her.
Call Me Dad focuses on a men's group in Melbourne called Heavy Metal, which stands for Men's Education Towards Anger and Life. And it was founded by David Nugent. He's a counsellor. He has been involved in men's programs for 20 years, and he joins me in the Life Matters studio this morning. Hi there.
Hi there.
I feel very moved to meet you in the flesh, actually, because you're an amazing presence with your co-counsellor in this documentary. Mm. And this is deeply personal for you, isn't it, this whole trajectory?
Yeah, it's been a journey for a long time, well before we founded Heavy Metal.
Why is it personal?
Well, you know, in reflection, I grew up in a violent family. I have memories of seeing my mother on the floor with things in the kitchen all smashed and broken glass, and her bleeding from the face or from the ears or nose. And, you know, I always said to myself, like, with the work that I do with men, a lot of us say we'll never be like our fathers. And as I grew older and got into relationships, I started to actually catch myself not being a nice guy.
And you really did catch yourself. Was there any particular time where you thought, I need to seek assistance, I need to change who I am, how I respond?
Yeah, us men are very good at wearing a mask. In fact, all of us wear a mask, women as well, but we pretend to be, you know, having a happy family. We pretend that we're great people, and you know, most of us are. We've all got a good heart. It's just sometimes that good person inside us gets lost. And I, at one particular time, some 20 odd years ago, probably 25 years ago now, I dropped the guard. I dropped the mask, and I was at a public at a public place with family and friends who knew me as that lovely guy. And I landed up, you know, smashing a family car with a bit of steel pipe, and just that act on its own scared everybody. Mm. And when I saw the faces of my children, who were only very young at the time, that was it. That was the turning point for me.
Well, you saw your own face in their face, didn't you, in a way? Your own little, your little boy's face.
Yeah, I saw the fear in their faces, like I saw the fear of when Dad was, losing his, being aggressive and violent towards my mother.
And so Heavy Metal has been born. It's a great title, I have to say. And in this documentary, you follow three men who have agreed to be filmed. I think that was a significant decision for them to take that, because they are revealing very confronting behaviours on camera. You are co-counselling, effectively, this group over 16 weeks with an incredible woman, Jackie Seamark, because she is a survivor of domestic abuse and of sexual abuse at the hands of her father, and yet she faces up to this group of men who could have been her perpetrators in some way again and again and again. Why? Yeah.
Well, Jackie and I have been we're a great team. We work really well together, and Jackie has a sort of softer approach in her mannerism, and I've got that rough sort of diamond edge to myself, and it works well. And why we do it? Because we believe men can change, and we want to help women in similar situations that are caught with these men. So we don't just do it for the men, we do it for the women as well. We also run a women's program alongside our men's program. And we've been, like I said, we've been doing it for 8 years now. And the journey, you know, it's tough. There's a lot of horrible stories. We hear a lot. We work with a lot of families. We work with a lot of the services involved in family violence, child protection, making referrals, police contact. But we keep working, because just like in the film, we see after we get past that struggle, and you actually they've done this very well in the film, towards the end you see that change, you see that shift.
Mm.
And because we've been doing this work so long, we get feedback from children, or we get feedback from women saying, thank you, we don't know what we would have done without you.
And the women's group is giving them power again too, which watching those two parallel paths with these three men, particularly for Sashko and his partner, Susanna, I think is profound. And I was struck too, Jackie Seamark says that she's the voice of the women and children in that room with the
exactly.
men, which is very confronting. How would you describe, for Justin, Nathan and Sashko, who have agreed to be filmed, how would you describe the role of anger in their lives?
Well, it's kind of it was something that they couldn't deal with. It was something that they knew they had, but they just kept shelving it and minimising it and sort of saying, it's okay, that's the norm.
And it's my personality, almost.
Particularly Justin's culture. He almost came thinking that there's nothing that we could do. This is it. That's the norm. You know, he's done some time in jail. He's had a very rough upbringing as a young teenager. And that's the interesting thing about this work. Sometimes you might find a guy that, you know, you think he won't change. But we just keep persevering and working away at it. And suddenly it's also the comradeship that forms in the group that they actually see someone else struggling, or they hear someone else's story, and they start to realise that they're not alone, that you know, there's a lot of us stuck in this position. And
anger is a reaction to the things that we can't manage in our lives.
Yeah, and you see that in the film again, where they almost get argumentative with me at one stage, with both Jackie and I, and calmly we persist trying to break that down. And some nights we you know, kick some goals. Other nights we sit there and we go, wow, you know, we're pulling our hair out of our head.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Justin walks in very sceptical about whether you're going to be able to change him. Nathan has a real ownership over his anger. You know, it's part of who he is.
Yep.
He gets
part
the shits. It's how he responds. That's how he describes it.
Yeah.
And they're very tightly coiled up, these men. In Nathan's case, he's lost his marriage.
Mm.
In Justin's case, I think so too. Sashko is on the cusp of losing his marriage.
That's right.
Susanna's an incredible presence in this documentary. How do you, because you can't change that habit of anger, that ferociousness overnight. So how do you chip away? What's the language that you're giving them?
Well, you know, on the very first night we talk about anger, and I sort of explore that with them, and I kind of get them to brainstorm, what is anger? And what is it? It's a feeling. Mm. It's an emotion. And we talk about whether anger is dangerous. And, you know, I've thrown that question out at a lot of PDs that I've done. And, you know, I was at a PD with a lot of GPs and I threw that question out and I said, so what do you think? Do you think anger is dangerous? And most people in that room put their hands up, just like these guys do in this in the class. They say, yeah, anger is dangerous. But how can it be dangerous? It's a feeling, just like happy, just like stress, just like feeling tired. It's an emotion. Where we get caught up in is that it's the expression of the feeling. It's the expression of the anger. And it's the expression that then becomes the behavior. That's what becomes dangerous. And once we separate those two and then start working on what choices we have in that expression, we then make the shift.
There's more to this than anger being an instrument. It's an instrument of control. And what you see in this documentary this week on Thursday is, you know, some fairly confronting conversations where groups of men are laughing about calling their partner a bitch or a client a bitch or you know, this laughter around a bruise. I mean, it was a beautiful moment, but it was a really confronting moment, laughing about a bruised face, you know. So control is at the heart of this too, isn't it? And
very
as
much so.
The men like Sashko loses control as he confronts his anger, that is incredibly confronting for him. He feels greatly diminished by that.
There's often too much emphasis on the anger, and in the group process, we work on the behaviour and the forms of abuse. And when we pull that back, it then starts to come back to about power and control. And it's about having control over the partner, having control over the relationship. And where Sashko in the film hit a crossroad was where he started to realise that he had to let go of vulnerability. And vulnerability sometimes gets in the way for us men, where we feel weak. You know, we've been taught that it's a sign of weakness to be vulnerable. In fact, it can be a sign of strength.
In our relationships.
In our relationships, in our, you know, relations with other men, in our the way we hold ourselves, you know, around other men in sporting events or at work. There's this kind of culture idea that, you know, we can't show weakness, we can't show vulnerability. And it comes from, you know, things that get passed on from generation to generation, like, you know, don't cry, men shouldn't cry, you know, don't be a sookie.
And Justin's confrontation is learning how to let his boy, little boy, be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And for him as a dad to allow that.
Yeah. And Justin, you know, that was a big struggle for him because he really held on to a lot of those culture ideas passed on about guys. And that exercise that you see us do in the film is that, you know, we spend almost 3 nights breaking that down and getting them to rethink, well, if that's so bad and unhealthy, how can we change that? How can we teach our sons? How can we role model a different behaviour?
Some men listening to this conversation, David Nugent, though, will still think this is about the emasculation of me, you know, that I have to let go of my masculinity and that makes them even more angry.
Or I don't know if that makes them more angry. It kind of might make them, what I find is that they won't come to address it. They stay away from it. And unfortunately, what's happening in our community with family violence is that, you know, the laws are changing. It's spoken about more. Police have got more powers. The magistrates in courts are saying you need to attend, you need to change this behaviour, you need to attend programs like ours. So some of them are forced into it. And usually they struggle when they don't want to let that go. And that's really tough for people like Jackie and I when we're facilitating such a program.
When do you know you're getting it right? What are the moments where you just, and there's a moment where you cry in this documentary with kind of joy, actually, and the men respond.
Yeah, that was an emotional moment for me because behind the scenes there was so much work going on as far as the struggles that these guys were having. And that's part of the program, that we do a lot of individual counselling with them or, you know, support work with the women. And to see them shift and take ownership is the moment when the language changes in the group. And you actually see that again in the film where the language changes. They're not arguing the point anymore. They're not justifying their point. They're actually starting to understand, which is something that men struggle with, is what empathy is all about.
And you see the peace in their face,
yeah,
and in their bodies and their relationships with their children. David Nugent, congratulations on the work and the documentary. It really is very impressive.
Thank you.
It's so great to have you with us in the Life Matters studio.
Thank you.
He's the founder of Heavy Metal, Men's Education Towards Anger and Life, and you can watch the documentary this Thursday on ABC television. Sarah Ferguson's Hitting Home kicks off tonight at 8:30, and also tonight on Big Ideas. In fact, the director of Call Me Dad, this documentary that airs, that David's part of, will be on tonight. 1800 RESPECT if you need support right now. 1800 RESPECT. Ring. Michael Cathcart, sorry to squeeze you.
Oh, squeeze me anytime you like. Colin McCann. Colin McCann is coming up.
Oh,
he's an
great,
amazing, amazing Irish writer. He's written a book called 13 Ways of Looking, and I think it's a perfect book. It's a harrowing book, but just wonderful. And we'll be asking the big question, are there too many festivals?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Colin McCann, though, very popular. 10 a.m. coming up.